Welcome back to the FKG podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Tara Dower, who set the overall supported AT-FKT, and her crew chief, Rascal. We chat logistics, hallucinations, fueling, as well as what motivated Tara to take on and succeed in this humongous challenge. Thank you so much, Tara and Rascal, for making time to come on the podcast. You just finished your AT-FKT like 3 days ago. I can't believe you're ready to do podcasts already.
Yeah, they've been coming in pretty hot and kind of got super overwhelmed about the first day. I didn't even really look at my phone.
We just slept,
just
on
hung
and off
out
all day.
And then the second day, started looking at my phone. I was like, ah, I need help. I need a lot of help.
Yeah. I know after I finished my self-supported, I didn't look at my phone like for answer media for a full week. I was like, I am not in the headspace to even respond to emails right now. So I was surprised you got back to me so quickly.
Yeah, I should probably just taking it easy. I have this friend who's going to help. So that's coming soon.
So how has your immediate recovery been? What have you been doing since you finished?
Yeah, lots of sleep, lots of naps, a lot of eating. Honestly, my body feels pretty good. I feel like if I properly warmed up, I could probably go on another run, like a light run probably. But mentally, I'm still in this brain fog. It's a little hard to process things. Definitely a lot of brain fog, but I've recovered pretty well. And my coach was like, yeah, we're going to probably get back to running in like a week or so.
Wow, that seems super fast.
Yeah.
So you've just lowered the overall AT record, the supported record, all records. You took it under 41 days for the first time. And I remember when Carl set the record that you just broke, and there were a lot of people who were like, oh, we're not going to see this challenge in our lifetime. This is going to stand for years and years and years. And yet here we are, like, what, 6 years later or something, and you've just taken over half a day off of his time. I would love to hear, and maybe you're still processing this, but your mindset and motivation in regard to the record, the goal from before you started, when you were out there, and how it changed, or maybe it didn't change, but what that was like as you moved through this FKT.
Yeah. Before I even started, I thought, like, why not me? Because when I'm in races, there are men that I'm beating, and I saw it as a race, like thinking about Christian in a race, or thinking about Carl Meltzer or Carl Sabe in a race, thinking about them, like, well, anything could happen. Like, thought, like, why not me? Why can't I get the record? Or why can't I win the race? Also, I completely believe women have a special gift of endurance, and it's a special opportunity to be out there as a woman and see what we can do. So I thought, like, well, we have our womanly abilities. There's so many men that go after this record. Like, let's see what a woman could do. And I was inspired by you and Jen Farr Davis to even attempt it. So I had that. And I was really confident with the right plan, with the right crew, I could at least try my best and see what I could do. But once I got out there, and once I was going through the tough parts of Maine and New Hampshire, and I started dropping behind my projected mileage, but for some reason, maybe my mileage was off. But before we knew it, there was a point where we're about 100 or so miles behind Carl Sabe.
Close to 200.
Yeah, close to 200. And I thought maybe it would have been 35. So I was like, wow, what happened? And I think I remember Rascal telling me how far I was behind. And she was extremely confident that we could get back there. But in my head, I'm like, this is going to be really difficult. And it kind of seems impossible. But I want to trust those people like Rascal, who I put in that place of crew chief. She is the one at the very top. I am like the race car. She's just telling me what to do and I'm doing it. She's the one that's making all the decisions and I have to listen to her. So in my head, I was like, oh, I don't know if this is possible. Like, this seems really impossible at this point. I don't know if I could do this.
You even said only one time do I ever remember her even entertaining the fact that we were only going to break the women's record or we were only going to break the South Bend record. There was only one time that she even entertained slightly giving up on the overall record. And it was right around that time when we realized how far we were behind on mileage. But we crew did not entertain that thought at all. We just were like, nope, we're just going to keep going.
Yeah, they had this extreme confidence in me and my abilities and how we were going to get back there. And I was impressed by them. That's really how this record happened. If it was up to me, I don't know. I think it's so important for anyone going after a record like this to have a crew that they can trust. Unfortunately, my mentality in these kinds of things is not as strong, but luckily I knew myself enough to put someone like Rascal in charge.
So Rascal, when you were seeing how far she was behind Carol's time and you're looking ahead to what she's going to have to do to recoup those miles, were you making adjustments to her schedule? Like, okay, you have to do 3 extra miles each day or whatever. Were you making all of those adjustments all the time on the fly?
Yes and no. I think her mom is also a huge part of this crew. Her mom, Debbie, trail name Omi, and I were the top two. We were in charge. And so we were the two doing the math all the time and figuring out what we needed to average for the rest of the time we had on trail. And once we figured out that we were far behind, we figured out a nice, comfortable average. And then in my mind, I just added 3 miles to it, like almost every single day, because I wanted a buffer. I wanted space for if we did have a day where we had to end early for some random reason, whether it be related to a physical thing or just something along the trail,
weather,
anything. I was like, we need a slight buffer. And the fact that we figured out that we were behind that early on, we had that time and space for the rest of the trail to nickel and dime was the catchphrase. It's like we're always nickel and diming every day, whether it's a mile, whether it's 2 miles, like it matters. It really matters. And so we definitely pushed hard for those extra 1 to 3 miles every single day, which Tara was not thrilled about most of the time.
I was going to say, Tara, did you know they were pushing you to do more than you had to each day? Did you know that there were like just miles accruing, or did you think you were just doing the bare minimum?
I didn't know about the bonus miles, but at one point I did message Carl Meltzer, who's been a mentor of mine for a while, and he was like, well, you have to do 56 to 57s a day to get it. And I think, well, she said 58s. I had to do 58s.
At that point, I was like 58, 59 every day, no matter what.
And then I told Rascal about what Carl said. And I just had to trust them because it's also based on the tempo of the trail. Like, how's the pace of the trail? How are the mountains that day? Like, what's it look like? Where can we nickel and dime? So it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter the minimum. We just had to take advantage of the trail where it allowed more miles. And I just trusted that she was doing everything that she needed to do. And it was really hard, but it worked out. I wish I could say I was completely confident in my abilities, but I wasn't. I was completely confident in my crew. And that's just the beauty of a supported effort. That's, you got to trust these people.
You fell behind in Maine and New Hampshire. And I think if people aren't necessarily that familiar with the AT, like that's the hardest, most technical stretch of trail. And so if you could just tell us about your experience in Maine and New Hampshire, like what was so challenging about it for you personally, but also why you chose to go southbound to start with that instead of northbound, which I believe is what Carl did.
Yeah, I chose to go southbound because I knew I would get those tougher parts done with sooner. Knowing myself, I know if I have something like New Hampshire and Maine coming up, like it is at the end, it is coming. I knew what I was getting myself into because I already thru hiked in 2019. I knew my body when I got there in 2019 during a thru hike was not happy. So I knew at the end of an FKT attempt, it probably 100% would not be happy about that decision. So I wanted to get it over with. Also, I wanted to complete a southbound hike because I already done northbound. I kind of want to go southbound and see how that feels. And mentally, it's cool to experience the trail in a different direction. And to describe Maine and New Hampshire for that other part of that question, southern Maine, the rocks really start and the rain began and wet conditions began. And that's when the rocks started, the big lows. It was just harder to keep up the pace that I had been keeping in central Maine. Mm-hmm. And that kind of messed with my head. But in addition to the weather, I remember going up the Bigelows with Rascal and it got so dark. It was the morning and it was light out. And then all of a sudden it got really dark. And then this deluge happened. And then we just heard the loudest thunder and so much lightning. And I was really nervous because at the top of the Bigelows is just some really bare mountains, some rocks. And so I was like, oh no, this is scary. So, I mean, you got the Bigelows that are pretty difficult. And then you go right into Grafton Notch and the hardest mile on the Appalachian Trail. And then you go right into New Hampshire, where you pretty much start with the Wildcats and Mount Moriah, which is just like up and down, and Wildcats is just like this crazy descent.
And you can't move fast.
You can't move fast, and the wet conditions made, I mean, I fell so often, my feet would just slip right from under me, and I would just hit my hips, and I just have bruises down my hips, and then we'd go up Mount Washington, and luckily the conditions were really good for that. Obviously, it was still a little wet and cold at the top, but with what I had the day before, it was really nice. So then we went on to the Zeeland area, and then more rain happened. And that was a tough day because we were going up Mount Lafayette and it was really, really cold. Mm. Luckily, I had a great pacer, Scott, who had done a winter through hike starting in December going Sobo. So he knew a lot about like winter conditions and kept me safe. Essentially, it's just really rocky. It's hard to keep a pace. Straight up, straight down. Sometimes you're climbing around waterfalls and up and down boulders, and it's just hard to keep a pace. And I knew that was coming, but I think mixed in with the weather, I don't feel the best when it's rainy and dark. Mentally, I'm not well. So I think day after day after day, having that kind of weather, as well as falling so often in the Whites and in Maine, and then also not keeping up a good pace. And it was just mentally demoralizing. I remember at the end of the Whites being completely depleted. And it took me a couple of days after the Whites to recover from just being in the Whites. I think it was the Kinsman's really the nail in the coffin. I remember just falling in a muddy puddle, just hands and knees, and the mud just splashed up in my face. It was just raining so much in the Kinsmen's. It was just so many puddles, and there's no mud bridges that were actually mud bridges. And I was just walking through mud, and I just fell in this mud puddle. And I'm just like, this is how it is. This is how it's going to be. It's a little demoralizing. Looking forward to nicer days.
I'm really glad we did that at the beginning.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Yes.
Really glad we did that. I think mentally too, she is someone who thinks about the future a little bit too much. And so thinking about us going north would have been, it would have been trying to distract her from thinking about the Whites and thinking about Maine for the entire time. Whereas going south, we got that out of the way and she could worry about other things.
I remember looking back when I was going up and down mountains somewhere in Tennessee or North Carolina, just one after the other. And I was just, oh, this is hard. This is hard. And then it came back to me. I was like, but also remember the Whites. Remember how demoralizing, how difficult that time was for you personally. Mm-hmm. It just was really difficult. So I'm really happy I went Sobo.
I had a lot of rain in New Hampshire and Maine on my self-supported AT hike. And I almost quit in the Whites as well. I hear you 100%. It's so demoralizing day after day after day. And you know that it's going to end, but it doesn't feel like it's going to.
Right. All I could look forward to was Hanover. That was it. That's the only thing. I couldn't look forward past Hanover. All I was looking at was Hanover. And if I could get there, I'd be okay.
That was what I said to myself 1,000 times a day. I was like, just make it to Hanover. Just make it to Vermont. It's just like the only thing that you can focus on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
For me, I know my feet were destroyed from all of that wet and that mud. Obviously, you were supported, so you had a little bit different. But were your feet in all this? Did you get hurt with all these falls? These sound like really brutal condition.
Yeah, I'm really clumsy. So I fell a lot in mixed with rocks, slick rocks, and just the nature of the Whites. I fell a lot. I didn't get injured ever. I was always afraid I was going to get injured. Just trying to be as careful as possible. And that slowed my pace down a lot because I'm just being extra gentle on these rocks. And I'd still fall somehow. My feet were pretty messed up for sure.
They still are.
Yeah, they're not looking great.
Yeah, there's no reprieve. It's not like you stopped.
No. And I had the opportunity to change my socks and shoes, and Christine was there and she helped with foot care. But I think that's when the holes started. I had two large holes, like caverns in my feet. It started with a blister and then somehow it just...
I've had that.
Kept going deep.
Yeah. And it just kept burrowing deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
It's the craziest thing. I don't
You're
know.
You're like, how deep can this go?
Mm-hmm. And I would just put like Neosporin in there, just fill up a little, like a little, little hole of Neosporin.
Fill it up and tape it over. And
yeah, hopefully, just don't look at it too deeply.
Right.
Don't look at the hole.
Yeah.
Unless you see red lines coming out of there, just don't worry about it.
Her pinky toes as well. Since day four, I was like, we're going to have to cut these things off. In the beginning, we would get a new pair of shoes or whatever shoe she was in, and she would just take a pair of scissors and stab the outside where her pinky toes could have just a tiny bit extra of room. And I'm like, I guess that's effective, but now we have gaping holes in our shoes too.
Yeah, those were helpful. But then I got to New York and I tripped on one of the holes in the shoes, got caught a low root that was sticking out, and it really dug into my pinky toe, and it basically dug a hole into the pinky toenail bed, and it was just like this hole then in my pinky toe.
That's when we stopped cutting holes.
Yeah, that's when I thought, well, maybe this isn't the best idea. But my feet, from all the wet, once it started drying out, they were better. But I just remember not even about the blisters, the sores, or the holes. I just remember the pain in my feet, just how sore they were from all the rocks and just all the banging.
Just being on your feet for that long.
The bottoms of my feet were just so sore. You can't do anything about that. You just got to keep going. I remember at one point near Sugarloaf, just more rocks. But I remember thinking when I was hiking end of the day, I just remember thinking, trying my hardest because Carl Sabe, I'm a student of Carl Sabe. I listened to everything he put out. I read everything that I could understand that wasn't in Belgium. Before this, Carl Sabe is my teacher. But I read something from him. He talks about how like your body wants to convince you to stop, or some pain isn't real, how it's just your body telling you to stop. So I thought of that, and I repeated to myself for maybe 15 minutes, this pain isn't real. And I would do this over and over, and it actually just dissipated, which was the craziest thing. Obviously, that didn't work every time, but for that one time, it did disappear, which is pretty crazy.
I was just waiting for everything to go numb for you. Yeah. I was just like, I bet at one point you're just going to stop feeling everything. Just wait for that. And I would just always, I'm like, you'll get numb. It'll go numb. Don't worry. I don't think it ever did.
No.
I have experienced that, but then it always ends up hurting again later. It's interesting because I feel like when I was doing the PCT in 2013, I had this moment of realization that your body will try to send you all of these signals to shut you down as a protective mechanism before you're actually at capacity, because it wants you to protect and preserve. And there is this kind of ongoing discernment when you're pushing yourself like this of, is this my body giving me an early warning sign? Or is this like, am I at my edge and I need to listen to this? And constantly trying to sort through what type of pain or signal you're getting. So it's really interesting that you were able to actually dissipate pain, at least in some instances, through that.
Yeah, I did my best. Tried to.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and just walk through your typical day, Tara. What was it like for you? I definitely want you to talk about the hobble. And when you woke up, what you ate, how long you moved, just step by step until you stop for the day.
Yeah. So we would either wake up in the tent because we did a lot of camping, or we would wake up in the van at a road crossing. So we wanted to implement as much tenting as possible because, again, Carl Sabe says you want to stay as close to even mileage as possible. You don't want to do way more to get to the van or way less to get to a van to sleep. So we try to do as even as possible mileage. And so Rascal and our other pacer, JP, would hike up camping supplies and food, and we would sometimes sleep in a tent. How often do you think we were in the tent?
Honestly, towards the end, it turned out to be almost 50-50. But the middle section of trail was more van than not. And then the earlier section of trail was more camping than not, I feel like. I think at one point we had 5 nights in a row that was camping, which was a lot. But also we sleep way better in the tent, and there's a lot less to do when you're camping, obviously, like distraction-wise. Because when you're at the van, you have every single thing. So you can be like, oh, wait, let's do this and this, or let's eat this and this. And when you're out camping, you're like, nope, this is what we got. And we got to do foot care, we got to eat, and we got to go to bed right now.
Yeah.
So camping was a good move on our part.
Yeah. So either way, we would always wake up at 3 o'clock, either in the tent or the van. And then I would start getting my feet prepared. So Luco tape and the socks took a while to get on. And Rascal would hand feed me. And that would take about 30 minutes to get the feet all prepared, get the shoes on. And then I would do some leg swings. I would warm up and then I would start. And so, yeah, I hobbled more so in the beginning, did more of a hobble. So the first hour is pretty difficult. It just takes a while to get your body prepared or get it warmed up and try to keep to a 3 mile per hour pace the best I could. If I wasn't going up a hill or a mountain the first thing in the morning, I tried to stay as close to that as possible. Just for my mental health, I like to stay as close to 3 mile per hour and then build on to that as I keep going through the day. And so that was the first hour. And then I would just keep going through the day about 1 or 2, depending on my pace, like 12 to 2, I would get halfway for the day. And then that was always nice. It's essentially you're going up a mountain, you get halfway, and then you're kind of going down. So it was always nice to get to halfway and be able to be counting down the miles, be closer to the end than further.
Until I came in and said, just kidding, you have 2 more miles than you thought today.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it was pretty basic, just moving all day. We were doing a lot of crew stops and pretty much cleaning the feet all the time. And I was sitting and eating there. And then I don't know where it was, maybe the Shenandoahs, where I was just like, no more of this. I only get to change my shoes and socks once a day. And so I'd get to the crew stops. I would probably do a couple things for a couple minutes and then head off with somebody who's going to come back to the crew area. And I would have some food and I'd have a protein shake and I'd be drinking protein shake and eating. And they would go back with that food and I would continue on with a pacer. And that was probably the most efficient period of time for the crew and me when I wasn't just like sitting down at every crew stop. And that adds up a lot. So that would go on, I don't know, about 4 to 6 crew stops.
Six? 6 seems about average.
All right. Another thing Carl Sabe always said was your body wants to run. It knows how to run. So I forced myself in the beginning to just get used to every single flat, every single downhill you're running. And that really helped my pace so much. I've told myself in past FKTs, it's okay to walk. We can hike. We can enjoy this section. I've done that. Did that a couple times with this FKT, but mostly I was trying to get my body used to running.
There was a switch at some point when most of the pacers, especially me, I would notice. I was like, oh, she's conditioned now. She's conditioned herself. If there is a flat, there is a slight down, or even if there's a slight up that she can run, she's going to be at least jogging it. She's not full out sprinting, but she's moving faster than if she was just like walking.
Yeah. Liz Durstein, who's a really good friend of mine, says any bit of running helps. Mm-hmm. Any little bit. That really helped me. That just was a good mind shift as well. So appreciate her for that. And so run and hike all day and then get to the crew area. 8:30 was really good. I had thoughts that I would get to the crew by 8 to 9 every night and that it ended up 8:30 I could do for a while. But then it started getting closer to 9:30. And then towards the end, it was getting closer to 9:30 or 10. And I'd be in bed by 10:30. And then one of the last full days, I think it was going into the knock, I got to the crew at 11:30. That was the latest. But luckily, I just had one full day until the last push after that. So it was kind of like an all-out thing. We were just going, going, going. But pretty much got to the crew between 8:30 to 10 o'clock. And then once I got to them, I would stretch. My friend Reese was like, you should probably stretch back in Maine. And once I started stretching, I was a lot less sore in the morning. So I would stretch for about 7 minutes and then would sit and my mom would hand feed me. And then JP would work on my feet. I would soak them and then would head to bed after that and would get about 6 was a lot of hours of sleep, but pretty much 5 was the average. And if it was anywhere under 5, we knew that was going to be a rough, rough day, unfortunately. I think my body just does not perform well with less than 5 hours of sleep. Luckily, I was able to maintain that.
So, Rascal, can you walk me through a day in the life of the crew? What were you guys doing behind the scenes? You're obviously waiting for Tara to appear. So what are you guys doing in between? What was your day like?
Well, usually the night prior, I have already planned out the next day's stops. And so I always say, like, all right, I sent out the schedule for the next day, and everyone looks it over and we see where the crew stops are. We see how many miles she'll be doing in between crew stops, and we'll line up as many pacers as we can to make sure she has as many pacers throughout the whole day as possible. Myself and JP were the main two pacers for most of the attempt. And so I would talk and be like, all right, you take morning, I'll take mid-afternoon. I usually wasn't able to do mornings because I wanted to make sure that crew was good in the morning. Because like she said, we're up at 3 a.m. She's taping her feet. I'm making breakfast. I'm making sure everything that we had charged is charged, and we've got the Garmin going. We've got the watch. We've got her phone, her AirPods. Everything's set. If she has a pacer for the first section, they are set with their snacks. They are set with the water and all the other little things that we have to have in their vest and for Tara and for them. If she's going out on a section alone, then I make sure her vest is fully loaded with all the things she needs, as light as possible. And then we would send her off. And depending on how many miles she had in the first section and how long of a drive it was to the next crew stop, I like to try and give crew at least minimally a 45-minute back to sleep, like quick get a nap in before we drive to the next one. In the beginning, it was really easy to let that sleep deprivation really hit hard. And there were a few times when I realized that us driving immediately after she takes off in the morning was dangerous. I had a lot of close calls in those early morning hours of like, I am falling asleep behind the wheel. And so until our bodies adjusted to the sleep deprivation, I wanted folks to have another 45-minute nap before we started driving, unless the drive was going to take a while, unless we were unclear about navigation or we knew the roads were going to be a little rough, because that was always hard. But then we get to the next stop and we'd again decide if we hadn't slept yet, maybe we get a little nap in. Or if she's going to be there within a half an hour, we get things set up and ready to go for the next section of trail. And it was pretty much the same deal for those six-ish stops every day. It's like, all right, we get the table out, we get the chair out, we get the water out, we have the snacks for the next section. We have a medical kit box, which we call the oh shit kit. That comes out. And we have a little trash bag and extra socks, another pair of shoes in case she wants to change them. And other than that, it's just like going over all the things in your head of like, what could she want when she gets here? Making sure there was another meal there for her. And then we had to-go meals that were called handhelds, which is usually a wrap or something like that that she could eat on the go. So it was basically just prepping and then packing it all again, driving to the next spot, prepping again and seeing what she needed. And then at the end of the day, it was the same deal of, we are ready for her to come in for the evening, and it is a race against time again, so we can just get as much sleep as possible. While mom's feeding, someone's warming up water for her foot soaking with some Epsom salts and making sure that everything in the van, if we're having a van night, is set. She has her pills out. We've got clothes laid out for the next day, snacks for the morning. It's just a constant nonstop cycle of everything. And in between all of that, it's dealing with whatever else pops up, because no day is boring. No day is exactly the same or consistent. It's something else has happened or someone else is coming in and it's coordinating all these other pacers and other people who are bringing things. And oh my gosh, this one person got stung by bees today. We need to figure that out and things like that. So it was just a lot of on the fly logistics.
So you've mentioned the van, and I know Tara's mom was also there on the crew with you, and you had people coming and going. How many vehicles? Did you just have the one vehicle? Were you guys leapfrogging? I want to know who's doing the laundry, because Tara always looked really clean, and I was like, why is she not dirtier? So somebody's got to be doing laundry.
3 showers.
She only took 3 showers.
That's well, so okay, bad. Your clothes right. looked clean. You, I'm sure, were dirty, but...
Yeah, that was the nice part about having so many people in and out. I did have the capacity once we got into a group being like, all right, you can go to town and you can do laundry and things like that. But minimally, we would only have the two vehicles. We would have the van and the Durango that mom drove. But that was only a few times. Most of the trail we had, I would say, between 4 and 8 vehicles of other pacers, other people coming in, friends, random people showing up and whatnot. And so it was like a giant caravan sometimes of 3:30 a.m. Everyone's lights switch on and we're just like beaming it down this dark road with 8 vehicles where usually nobody ever goes to different trail crossings. And then divvying up all the different things that need to happen during the day, like you said, laundry and other things. Going into town, mom was really good about being like, okay, I'm going to go into town to the grocery store and get XYZ for Tara. Or if people were coming in, we'd be like, hey, on your way, can you stop and get this?
Right.
And whatnot. So it was a lot of that.
You know, there's this aspect of like taking care of Tara and keeping her moving. But in order to do so, you've got to do things like getting groceries or getting more ice for the cooler or doing her laundry. You've got like two roles and two like aspects that you're juggling.
Definitely. Making sure that we were filled up with water, making sure that we had enough gas to get to wherever we're going.
Getting gas in the car. Like yeah. You got to make sure you're not running out. Yeah.
And so many different people were driving so many different times that you'd pop in the morning and be like, oh, we've got a full tank. And then you'd pop in a couple hours later and you'd be like, oh, I need to stop now because I'm going an hour and a half to this remote trail crossing where there's no gas station, up a long dirt road, no service.
So Tara, I want to cycle back to what you were talking about with your sleep and not doing well in less than 5. And this is something I saw all kinds of people out there breaking down your stats and comparing them to Carl's and stuff like that. I'm not a numbers person. I don't do stats. I can't even do my own stats when I'm out on trail. But I do know that there is this trade-off of speed versus sleep, especially as these long FKTs are becoming more and more competitive. You have to either move faster or sleep less. And I would like to know your philosophy on that, how that went for you. Obviously, you said there's a limit at what your body needs. And you obviously had to overcome a huge deficit. And you weren't necessarily moving faster than Carl's. Were you just digging into your sleep time? How was this sleep versus speed trade-off going for you throughout the effort?
Yeah. Well, I had all the intentions of sleeping as much as he did and running quickly. I knew he would be faster because looking at his daily mileage, the miles per hour, I knew that he was going to be faster. I mean, he's an incredible trail runner. I don't know how he did what he did. It's incredible. And how he got so much sleep, it's just incredible. And I knew I would probably be off a little bit, but I didn't realize that my miles per hour would be that much less than his. I was hoping to get more than 5 hours of sleep and just kind of had to accept the fact that that wasn't how it was. And these were the cards that I was dealt. And that's just how it was going to be. And 5 hours was like pretty good. I definitely got less sometimes in the whites. But yeah, I wasn't moving as fast as he was and just accepted that fact. And a lot of people talk about the sleep deprivation, and I felt like the compounding exhaustion really happening towards the middle of the trail. I don't remember when it was, but I literally told Rascal at one point, I texted her, and I was like, I need more sleep. Mm-hmm. And I was begging her for less miles. And I know I'm not thinking about the attempt at that point. And I keep going back to this, but she is a big reason why we got the record as Rascal and what she had planned for me and how she encouraged me to do that. But I was just begging her for one day for less miles. And I told her, because I genuinely felt this. I really hope that there's a bear that comes out of the woods and mauls me lightly.
Lightly.
Lightly mauls me. So I go to the hospital and I can sleep for a little longer. They can bandage me up and I can go back on trail. I just want that. So this is how much I want to sleep. So please, can we please sleep more today? Can I please have less miles? And I don't know if I actually got that. I don't think I actually ever got that request, and that's fine. And I'm okay with that because it ended up being a good result. But yeah, the compounding exhaustion was happening. It was pretty intense. I was hallucinating. I remember hallucinating a lot middle of the trail, and they're little micro hallucinations is what I called them, where it was little things like a little devil sitting on a stump and a person hanging from a tree and very scary stuff. And like sometimes a little lion, I remember a lion, and then dogs and cats, just little things here and there. I had a really, really vivid the last day with Liz Durstein. She was sitting on a stump. I was like, oh, hey, Liz, like this is normal seeing Liz sitting here on a stump. I came to and she wasn't there. And I was like, that was bizarre. I need to finish this thing before I go crazy. Something's going on. I don't like it. And immediately after that, maybe, I don't know, a couple minutes later, I tripped on this log really bad. And yeah, so all of this to say, it was really hitting me about mid-trail a little bit before that. It was difficult. Yeah, it was difficult.
And I definitely took that into account. I didn't fully understand that in the very beginning because I was like, yeah, we're all tired, of course. But then I was texting with Carl Meltzer at one point, and he said, if she loses a lot of sleep early on in Maine, it's going to really affect her in southern Maine, which means she's going to really be affected the entire rest of the trail. So I definitely stressed a lot about her losing sleep for sure. But it was still like, we have to get miles in no matter what. And so we just need to figure out a way how to make it so it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember Carl Meltzer, he even told us she can't get anything less than 6 hours. Yeah. And I had to overcome that mentally. Yeah. Like, this is just how it is. I need to be okay with this. I need to normalize this. He's got so much expertise in that area. Gosh, he just knows the trail so well. He knows sleep deprivation. And I just had to be like, well, we're just going to see how it is for me personally. It could be different.
But you knew we had to be consistent with what we were doing too, because there was only two times the entire trail that we decided to bump our sleep by a half an hour. And we got up at 3:30 instead of 3 and then started hiking at 4 a.m. And there was only two times that we did that in the 40 days. So yes, we lost a lot of sleep on a lot of those evenings when we got in late, but there was only two times when Tara and I would talk and we'd be like, okay, it's acceptable though to give us another half an hour in the morning. And she took a lot of trail naps. I think those were really important. And a lot of people don't understand that literally 1 minute and 30 seconds of her just lying on the ground in the middle of the trail, whether she falls asleep or not, that does revive her. She would get up and she would be groggy for a minute, but then she would just like, okay, I had my nap. I'm focused in, I'm dialed, and let's get to the next stop, you know?
I was extremely thankful that my pacers allowed me to sleep for a minute and a half. I was like, thank you. Thank you.
Only a minute.
I'm forever indebted to you, pacer. Yes.
There was definitely a shift at a certain point in your Instagram where most of your stories were you asleep in the middle of the trail. And I was like, she's hit that point.
A lot of trail naps.
Absolutely.
Love me. Minute and a half.
The power of the dirt nap. It is really incredible for sure. Did you reach a point where you just fell asleep instantly? Like you're on the ground and you were just asleep?
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like I was floating. Like I wasn't like asleep like you would be. It was just kind of like you were aware, but also just floating. And I was asleep. It was hard to explain. It was like this, I was instantly like not there, but I was like floating in this like in between area, I guess. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, I've definitely like for myself just done the thing where it's just like lay down and just like instant, like I'm falling asleep as I'm laying down onto the ground. Like I'm losing consciousness. And it's amazing. Like you said, just a short, tiny nap and then it feels like you slept for hours. It's interesting what your brain can do to reset yourself in that time. You don't necessarily have to take really long naps. The sleep deprivation aspect of these really long efforts is very fascinating to me.
Yeah. And going back to between me and Carl, he obviously was a lot more efficient, moved a lot more efficiently on trail. But there was little things I knew I could do to catch up to him, which was big one was not sleeping as much and minimizing a lot of crew stops, not stopping with the crew as often, or not stopping and staying there as often.
In camping.
So I'd like to, while we're kind of talking about the sleep aspect and you know, the kind of pushing through that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like your last 120 something miles, you did not stop to sleep. You were just doing that whole last chunk is like this one big push, right?
Yeah, so it was like 129 was the last push, but around 59 miles in before a big 14 and then a 16-mile section overnight. I took a 20-minute nap in the van when I got to a road crossing. So there was 20 minutes, which was glorious. 23 minutes.
23. The section before we got to the van, it was only, I think it was a 5-mile section. It was her and I and another friend of ours from trail named Matador. And those 5 miles, she cried the entire time just from pure exhaustion and knowing that this was the beginning of the push and knowing how hard it was going to be.
Yeah.
And I knew that she needed something. She needed some kind of little reset before this next last final big push. So we got to the road. I had already texted the crew. Mom had everything set. We shoved her in the van for 20 minutes. I opened the van door and I said, okay, it's time to go. And she said, I need 10 more minutes. And I said, okay, you can have 3 more minutes. And she passed out again, 3 solid minutes. And then when she got up, she looked like death. And I was nervous. I was like, is she going to keep moving? Like, what's going to happen? And Mom climbed into the van and shut the door and gave her the pep talk of a lifetime. I feel honored that I was there. I was getting emotional by what Mom was saying in order to just get Tara to literally just try to keep going. And Tara, like, sitting there, shaking her head, taking it all in, and she just, without a word, finished putting her shoes on, got up, and her and Mom walked to the trail together, and she took off. And that was the last time that she actually slept for more than a minute and a half in a dirt nap for the rest of the push. So
I think before starting that push, I got 3 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. So I was already riding that line of not happy.
That was the second time that we decided to sleep till 3:30.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I was out hiking, and every time I got service, I was checking your guys' Instagram because I knew you were going to finish that night. So I kept checking in. And I remember seeing this video of you somewhere, and it was dark. And you were literally just walking like a zombie. I was like, I don't even know if Tara's aware that she is moving right now, because you could tell you were just going forward and that was like all. Could you just tell us like what that push was like in your head? Talk about how you felt after you talked to your mom and got that pep talk. What was your mental process and state throughout this big last push that you did?
I would say like it hit around 9 miles in where the zombie walk started. Yeah, so I guess like 5 miles before, I just realized this is the last push. I'm really exhausted already. My body feels okay. I can definitely push, but mentally I was not well. I was just really not looking for this 14-mile section. I was just exhausted. And I just cried that entire 5 miles. And yeah, so once I started that, I think it was around midnight. And you just put your head down and you just get through it. Like, I could not keep my eyes open. It was just like, so tired. I knew it would be rough. That was always an issue for me. Once I'm tired, like, I can't get out of that mindset. Like, oh, I'm so tired. But throughout the trail, when I was tired, it was usually the early mornings. And eventually the sun was going to come up and I knew it was going to get a lot better. But it was like 11 and midnight. And I was like, this is going to be a long, long night on the 16-mile section. I just knew I just had to keep pushing. Luckily, I had a great pacer there, Hunter, and he just encouraged me, like, just keep something in your mouth, keep chewing, because chewing is going to help you keep you awake and keep fueling the best you can. And it was just a grind. It was just getting through it. I was so exhausted. He was hiking behind me because throughout like the southern end of the trail, we had really bad yellow jackets. Mm-hmm. And so I would disturb the nest. And then by the time the pacer would get the brunt of the yellow jacket. So I always had the pacer behind me and got stung during that section.
Gosh.
So many times. But anyways, he was hiking behind me. This is how out of it I was. I don't remember this at all, but I was walking and I guess I stepped on a snake, a copperhead. I just stepped right snake. Yeah. And I just kept walking and Hunter jumped. I saw him behind me and his headlamp like went up wherever. And I like looked behind me because his headlamp was like jostling around. He'd like jumped over something. He's like, oh no, I thought I saw a snake, but it was a stick. It was a stick. It was a couple miles later. He's like, Tara, I think you should really, I just want to let you know, if you could just keep your eyes open for any snakes. I know there's a lot of snakes in this area. He later tells me that I literally stepped on a snake and I just did not realize at all.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I was just kind of like begging for dirt naps here and there and trying to trying to just get through those miles. And then the sun came up. We were going up. After that, I had a 14-mile section with a new pacer, Jason. And the sun would come up in maybe 3 or so hours. And we were going up Blue Mountain out of Unicoi. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it's called. And there was a lot of bears and a lot of coyotes. And it was kind of a sketchy section.
And Jason loves to tell you about what's going on.
Oh, yeah. Jason loved to tell me how many bears were going to be around in that area, which was fine. I mean, we did see a lot of bears, but it was okay. And yellow jackets weren't that bad. Mm-hmm. But once the sun came up, I felt a little better. But, you know, the exhaustion would come in waves. It was like, you know, still after the sun came out, it was just like, you know, you get so tired and then, you know, you'd wake up again. It was just like a constant cycle of like exhaustion. And so sleepy, and the eyes would get so heavy, and then you'd be awake. It would be like a cycle of like an hour of like complete exhaustion, just like walking and trying to run the best you could. And that kind of lasted to the very end. It was getting a little sketchy, like I said, like around Blood Mountain, where I had that really bad hallucination where it's just like totally vivid. Liz is sitting right in front of me. And I fell. And I was always so nervous to fall on trail because I had so many violent falls where I'd fall and like, you know, hurt my hip. I had one time with Abigail going up Chioa, and I fell really badly on my hip. There's just a lot of really bad falls, and I was so afraid that, you know, I'd be so exhausted or I'd have hallucination so badly that I would you know, hurt myself. And I didn't let myself believe that I was going to get the FKT up until like 3 miles before the end, because I thought, you know, at least with 3 miles to go, I could crawl. I had enough power to crawl. So, yeah, 3 miles. I was just like, this is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then it happened eventually. But
we weren't allowed to ever tell her that it was going to happen. Sure.
Absolutely not.
And so we were just knocking on every piece of wood we could find.
For the last 4 days, I knocked on maybe 300 trees.
Yeah. And we always had to phrase it as, barring any incident or injury, like whenever we were talking God about willing. The end, God willing that nothing happens, barring incident, injury, the van is okay.
Knocking on wood.
Like knocking on wood. We had to say like all this whole spiel before we could be like, when we get to Springer, you know.
Oh, I hated like even entertaining the idea that it was going to end the way we would hope it would end.
Yeah.
And it did.
It did. It was great.
It was because we knocked on all that wood. That's
and
why.
And we had time, which was – we had like a loose buffer towards the end. You know, we finished, 13 and a half-ish hours prior to the record. And so there had been a loose schedule of miles written up for the last 8 days by Warren Doyle. Actually, him and I consulted on what was going on the last 8 days. And he was like, this is how you get an A+, and this is how you get an A++. And all of those schedules were for us to get in on Sunday morning. But we, at the end, decided to push to get to Springer before midnight. So we could get there under the 40 and say we got there on Saturday before midnight on Sunday and all this. So there was a loose buffer towards the end that we could have taken a few more hours to sleep, and we could have, you know, maybe negated some of your anxieties about being so tired that you're going to fall and just lose it and whatnot. But Crew just knew that she wasn't going to want to stop at that point. Is the other thing is she had always kept saying like, at the end, I'm just going to want to push. And I didn't really know what that meant in terms of mileage, but I guess 129 is
the number.
It was the number.
Apparently that's what it meant.
Yeah.
It's a good thing you knocked on all those trees if you're going to go stepping on snakes in the middle of the night. Because that could have been very bad to get bit by a copperhead so close to the finish.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Apparently, yeah, that's what I hear. Historically, it's not a good idea. A step on a copperhead.
I was so paranoid about running into a copperhead, and I did run into one, but I did see it and I didn't step on it. I like politely excused myself and went around, but I can't even imagine just stepping on one. So One last big aspect of a big FKT like this that I like to talk about is your food, your fueling, and your weight management, because your expenditure of calories is huge. So I'm sure, like Rascal, I'm sure you put a lot of thought into this too. And like keeping Tara's weight up, keeping you properly fueled, like did you struggle to eat? Like how did your fueling go? What was your strategy? Did it have to adapt along the way? Like just kind of talk us through all of that.
So they kind of did all of like the math on what I needed to eat and bought all the food. And we had several people that came in that helped us with those logistics. But for me personally, I ate really well, which was really surprising. I don't normally eat well during these types of things. During the Mounds of Sea Trail, which is a trail across North Carolina, I really struggled to eat, was very iron deficient, was falling apart, was sickly looking.
She would vomit some nights.
Vomit all the time. Yeah. Was really nervous for that because also in ultras, I throw up at least once. That's lucky if I can only throw up once during an ultra, but usually it's multiple. So I was really nervous for that, but it turns out I was eating super well. I was getting food down. I only threw up once because I swallowed a bug and was coughing so violently that I made myself just do a little throw up. So that was the only time.
When was that?
That was in the Smokies with Hunter. I swallowed a bug and just coughing so violently. Yeah, I ate super well and the crew just had food for me to eat. There was times where I was a little full and I would tell them like, oh, I need like 10 or 15 minutes, but pretty much stuck to like a standard schedule of eating, and mm-hmm. Rascal could go over that.
Were you making food requests? Did you have cravings and stuff like that? Or were they just going to be eating your food and you just put it in?
Food was just another thing to do out there. I didn't have any cravings. I mean, there was times where it's like, oh, McDonald's sounds really good or this or that, but I just ate because I had to, and mm-hmm. food was just a thing to keep going. It was not like an enjoyable thing. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, I love this. I like gummies and I like Rice Krispie treats, but they would hand me food and I'd have to eat it. That was just how it was. Food was how to keep going.
She didn't have any requests, but she did go through phases. It would be like, oh, she's eating a lot of sugar right now. That's what she's wanting. It's asking for. So we really went in on the sugar. And then a day later, she'd be like, I need more substantial stuff. I just need something that's more filling and not going to give me the sugar rush. And we'd be like, okay, we're switching it up. Only substantial stuff. And then we would only do substantial stuff. And then the next day, she'd be like, does anyone have any Skittles or Twizzlers? What's going on? So,
where are all the Skittles?
Yeah, she didn't have requests, but there was a lot of phases we went through. Mom and I had this box that just sat on the floor of the van, the snack box, and it was filled with a lot of different things. And then we would have to toss out a lot of other stuff. We're like, Tara's not eating this anymore. She didn't like eating things out of bags that you had to pick with your hands and put in your mouth because we were all really cautious about hand washing and stuff because it's really hard to stay clean out there. And the last thing we want is the neurovirus to disrupt this whole venture. So in the beginning, we were giving her potato chips and things like that. And then a weekend, she's like, nope, I can't do chips anymore because I can't just pick it out and put it in my mouth. I don't want to do that. But yeah, food-wise, when it was just Mom and I week one, we definitely struggled to not only make sure all the logistics were handled and everything else, but then to have time to make food. We were just making ramen and mac and cheese and things that were really quick and a very hiker-like diet because that's pretty much what I know mostly from being a thru hiker. And then luckily, we had a lot of trail angels come in and out. Two specific folks, Amy and Steve, who are full-time van lifers who can cook literally anything out of their van that you could want. And Amy knows nutrition and she knows how to put good nutritions and calories and protein and sodium and everything into such good food. And so she started making our sit down meals, we call them, in our handheld or to go things like wraps and pizza rolls and I don't know, pierogies and all this good stuff, hard boiled eggs and things like that. So things that were very substantial. And she was a huge help on that. When we packed out dinner to go camping, she would give JP and I a food baby, which was like a 3 to 5 pound, just giant container of food. And we would bring that in for Tara and the three of us with usually one spoon would just eat it. And so she ate a lot better than any of us had expected. And she did give in to, I'm just going to eat whatever you guys hand me. Really good.
We also did at every cruise stop, we did a protein shake by First Endurance called Ultragen, 320 calories. That was another helpful tip from Carl Meltzer. He was super helpful in advising for nutrition. He said, you want to drink a protein shake, whatever it is, at every single cruise stop. And that was so crucial.
320 calories, 4 to 5 times a day.
Yeah.
Minimally. So that was just another way to get more calories in her, because it was hard for you to just eat all the time.
Yeah.
So the fact that we had a lot of calories for her to just drink was really, really crucial. It helped too that our van is fully equipped. We have a fridge and a freezer in there. And so we were able to keep a lot of good food around, which was really nice.
That
was so good.
Yeah. I can only imagine at a certain point, your job is to just put food in your mouth and move your feet. Like that is like your job. That's what you're doing. So Tara, thank you again so much for coming on the show. I just want to give you an opportunity. If there's anything I haven't asked about, or if there's a takeaway from this that you want to share, just if there's any final thoughts you have that you want to share with our audience.
I really wanted women to come out of this attempt, either way, whatever way it went. I wanted women to have, to be inspired, or whatever, be encouraged, to go after a tough goal, no matter if it's in running and FKTs or if it's just in life. I wanted women to look at this and think like, oh, like this is happening over here. Like maybe I could do this over here. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that I know that women have a special gift of endurance. I have said that. I'm not a scientist, but I just know that if we get more women out to these longer trails or out on the trails or out doing just FKTs, I just know we are going to just keep lowering that bar. And I just want to see more women going out there. And there are a lot. Like we had Jenna who came out and did went for a self-supported record, and she did amazing.
Jasmine and Barkley.
Yeah, Jasmine the Barkley. And then we had Sarah who came out and tried. She got through the Smokies. She's going to try it again. I mean, that's super inspiring. I just hope to see more women coming out here and just going for that, because we have so many men going for the record. And it would just be cool to see like this influx of women just like encouraging each other and going for these really tough records. And it doesn't even have to be a record like this, a huge Appalachian Trail, but like there's a lot of smaller trails. There's a lot of like trail runs, just, you know, getting out there and seeing what we can do and how we can lower the bar together as women. I would love to just see that, an influx of women. And, you know, I was inspired by you and Jen. So I'm hoping that in some way I can also be that inspiration for other people, and me and Rascal. I mean, having women here supporting each other, I hope inspires women. So I just hope my message is, I just hope women come out of it like, maybe possibly I could do something like this and entertain the idea. But I also partnered with the Girls on the Run, and I luckily have reached my goal and exceeding it. Thank you to everyone who's already donated. It's still open, and it would love to see more donations going that way. Ultra is matching donations too. So that's incredibly, yeah, it's just so huge. So if anyone's interested, there is still a fundraiser going on for Girls on the Run, and I could provide you, Heather, with that link. But it is a great organization, a great program for young girls to not only learn about running and get into a running community, but also learn, you know, just skills,
like self-confidence,
yeah, mental, yeah, you know, physical, skills, and just be in a community of women that are supporting them. So it's definitely a great organization to donate to.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And judging by what I've seen online, you certainly achieved your goal of inspiring women through this. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing about it. I appreciate all you do for encouraging people to get out there and pursue their goals.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you. You inspired us too. We listened to your book a lot throughout the trail.
Yeah.
Tara would pick a section and be like, oh, we're hiking this section. Let's listen to that part of Heather's book.
Yeah.
And then the minute you started talking about the next section, she'd be like, all right, turn it off. We can't listen to the next one. We haven't gotten there yet.
So cool. It was so fun to listen to that. Bring it.
I'm glad it could be a tiny part of your FKT.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Tara and Rascal, for coming on the show. You can read about Tara's FKT on the website fastestknowntime.com and follow her adventures on Instagram at tara.dower.